town, and I thought it was a long shot, but I was just seeing if we could squeeze one in right then, just because I'm going to be...
So, hi, everybody. Welcome to the Climate Literacy Network call. As we always do, are there any announcements this week? But one thing that I did, I sent this out in the email reminder for today, is that the NRC, National Research Council's Climate Change Education Roundtable, is next Tuesday, March 6th. It's most of the day. I attached the agenda and the URL to the agenda, and people who are not physically there or on the roundtable can participate remotely. And I think there's a registration link on the website. You can sign in, and I don't know if the phone number is just going to be posted or whether they send you the phone number if you register. But that opportunity is available to anybody who is interested. Okay. Another thing that's happening relatively soon is the NSTA meeting is at the end of March, and it would probably be useful if we sort of got a list of those climate-related sessions from people in the Climate Literacy Network call. Might be useful to have there. I'll be going to be in a number of booths and making a presentation on clean, and so we could provide that information if we can get it together. So.
Mm-hmm.
We can try to get that together. Any other announcements? Okay, well, we will then move on to our presentation for today. Today we have Dr. Ted Maybach from George Mason University. He is a distinguished university professor and director of the Center for Climate Change Education, and he's had a long career, 25 years of experience as a public health communicator and social marketing researcher and practitioner. And he's also been very involved with the report that most people know about, the Six Americas report. And he's also leads one of the CSEP, the Climate Change Education Partnership projects with TV meteorologists. He's going to talk to us today about that effort, that TV meteorologists as climate educators. And so, Ed, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Tamara. So, although I actually prepared a PowerPoint presentation, it totally didn't occur to me that this was just a teleconference.
People will download the slides, and you should refer to your slides, and people will go through them themselves.
Okay. I don't want to sort of bog this down involving the slides too much, but I will stick to the order of the slides, and I'll try to refer to them so people can move along with me. The first slide is essentially just the abstract that we sent out in advance, figuring that this would that would be helpful on the website. But the topic, sort of the ideas that I want to share with you, really begin with the notion of trust and how important it is that for trust to be present, if education is to occur, the fact that the American public is you know, markedly less trusting of pretty much all institutions in our country now than they used to be. We really are at an all-time low. The next slide simply shows a couple of data points to that effect. Shows that the green.
What I need to do now is just sit and listen to this conference call, and then
Joe,
back out.
Excuse me. Can
Joe, put it on mute, okay?
Mute your phone, please.
As you can see from the green line in the middle of the page, trust has been trending downward. Trust in the scientific community, interestingly enough, is high and has been high for quite a number of decades. Trust in the military, you can see, is ascending, and trust in Congress is low and really can't get too much lower. We're, of course, mostly interested in what source. Who do the American people trust in terms of a source of information about climate change? And so we've been using our national polls. We, being Tony Lizerowitz, Connie Rosa Renouf, and myself, have been using our national polls, the Climate Change in the American Mind polls, to probe how Americans think about different potential sources of climate change information and the degree to which they trust them or don't. This slide from our 2010 survey shows that scientists are clearly the most trusted source. This with weathercasters coming in second, everybody else falling behind that, news media particularly far behind weathercasters, interestingly enough. In our 2011 survey, we expanded on that a little bit by asking about different federal agencies who are participants in the USGCRP, the Global Climate Change Research Program, all of whom are, you know, essentially part of the federal infrastructure on climate change. And what we found is, as you can see from this slide, that not only are scientists trusted, but really the whole range of government science agencies that are involved in climate change research are reasonably well trusted as sources of information about climate change, markedly more so than the president, somewhat more so than TV weathercasters, and again, markedly more so than the news media in general and people's elected representatives in Congress. The problem, as I see it, the problem with these findings is that trust, when we ask about trust in various sources, we think that that people are telling us how much they trust an organization in the abstract. In other words, most people don't know a single scientist who could speak to the issues of climate change. The next slide shows you a Research America poll done in 2010 where people were asked if they could name a living scientist. And two out of three people said, no, they can't. They can't name a living scientist. And of the one out of three who took a shot at it, most people named scientists who were deceased, some, in many cases, long deceased. So if you go to the next slide and look at my little cartoon character, this is who I think my respondents are telling me about when I ask them how much they trust scientists as a source of climate change information. They trust scientists in the abstract, not in the specific, because as I've showed you, most people can't even think of a single living scientist, much less a climate scientist that they personally know. Tony Connie and I actually have investigated the impact of the East Anglia email scandal, which we are told not to call ClimateGate. But in this article, we in fact did call it ClimateGate. We were interested. We just happened to get lucky, and we were going to the field with a survey about 6 weeks after the ClimateGate story broke. And so we asked people the degree to which we asked them if they had heard of the story. We didn't mention it as ClimateGate, but we described the incident. And we asked them if they had heard of it. If they had heard of it, we asked them how much attention they had paid to it. And if they had paid any attention at all, we asked them to what degree did it influence their trust in climate scientists. And what we found is that only about a quarter of the public had paid any attention to it at all. But of that one quarter, what you're looking at on this slide, the impact of ClimateGate on trust in scientists, it shows that about half of that quarter, in other words, about 12 or 13% of the public, responded to ClimateGate by essentially coming away with reduced trust in scientists as a source of information about climate change. So it's not a colossally large impact, but it's not an impact that we can just shrug our shoulders and say, well, no big deal. Let me sort of position that then with a question to you, which is my question to you is, who is Canada's most trusted person? Somebody has to give me a break and shout out a name.
Anybody can guess?
Well, Wayne Gretzky is usually the name that gets shouted out first. Other hockey players get shouted out next, and so I've gone ahead and said it's not a hockey player. In fact, if you go to the next slide, it's David Suzuki. David is a biologist, a geneticist. He is very clearly a bona fide scientist. He's also the nature of a Canadian Broadcasting Corporation TV show called The Nature of Things. This is 3 years in a row, in fact, that he has been voted by the readers of Reader's Digest, I believe. Should be on the slide, but it's not. He's been voted Canada's most trusted person for 3 years in a row, and I just love what Jackie Fitzpatrick said at the bottom of the slide. He knows how to reach out and explain things so the common man understands. So a wonderful quality, knowing how to having expertise and knowing how to share it so the common man can understand. So what I've just presented to you is the fact that in abstract, scientists have suffered as a trusted source of information about global warming, but David Suzuki, a living, breathing, you know, flesh-based, carbon-based human being, his credibility has not suffered. So it's well and good that members of the public trust climate scientists, but if they're trusting climate scientists in the abstract, as opposed to specific known trusted individuals, they are very much sort of the trust that we placed in climate scientists is very much threatened by sort of the exigencies of public events. So what's going on here? Why is David so trusted? This is pretty easily understood if you know the social psychology literature. 50 years of literature establishes unlike what our grandmothers told us, familiarity doesn't breed contempt. It breeds liking. People we are familiar with, we tend to learn to like. People who we like, we tend to trust. So this whole relationship that really has led to David becoming Canada's most trusted person is really based in familiarity. He couldn't ever have become Canada's most trusted person if it weren't for the fact that he was coming into Canadians' living rooms on a weekly basis for the past 22 years. So what is this? What are the implications of this for weathercasters and weathercasters as climate educators? We think that weathercasters basically have all of the same qualities as David Suzuki. Most of the same qualities as David Suzuki. We bring them into our homes routinely. I'll show you that data in a moment. Therefore, they're familiar to us. I heard my friend Joe Witte on the phone. When I walk around in the streets of D.C., I'm completely used to being anonymous, but when I walk on the streets with Joe Witte, I'm no longer anonymous. I'm now a guy walking next to a local celebrity. And it's absolutely remarkable the number of people that recognize Joe, you know, who has been a TV weathercaster in our market for the past number of years. And so he's very familiar. He is clearly liked. And if people think about Joe in the way that they think about weathercasters in general, he is trusted as a source of information about climate change. Moreover, like David Suzuki, America's TV weathercasters have an incredible opportunity to educate their viewers about climate change because we tune them in, we listen to them so frequently. The next slide shows just some of the data from our own surveys in terms of what is the genre of TV show that is most popular. It's local TV news, by far the most popular genre on television. The slide after that shows the type of information on the news that people pay most attention to. It is local weather, again, hands-down winner. And then a survey done in December of 2010 by the Rasmussen Reports showed that essentially 71% of American adults say that they get the majority of their information about the weather from TV. Mostly local TV, but 19% are tuning into cable TV for their weather. It strikes me as kind of hard to believe, given that I tend to get my weather information on my iPad or my phone or my computer, but I'm clearly out of step in that regard because 7 out of 10 adult American adults are still turning to TV to get the majority of their weather information. So, which leads me to the first premise of our project. And by the way, I've invoked Joe Witte now, so I should take a moment and thank Joe Witte for having dreamed up this project in the first place. This project is really wholly attributable to a phone call, a cold call that Joe made to me about 3 years ago, in essence proposing, making the premise that you see on this slide, that because of their trust and their access, TV weathercasters have an unrivaled opportunity to educate the public about climate change. I said, "Wow, well, that's quite a statement, Joe. Why don't you come out to my office and let's talk about that?" And he took me through the whole thing. He absolutely convinced me that this premise is valid, and we have been collaborating on this work ever since.
Hey, can I ask a question along those lines? Because I too don't have time to look at the TV news and the weather. I'm always getting my weather information from my iPhone or my computer, but isn't a lot of what is on the TV then put on the web? like do the TV caster, weathercasters use that avenue also?
The weathercasters do use the web. They put information up on the web. From what I've learned from the weathercasters that I've gotten to know over the past couple of years is that they are expected to do more, like the rest of us, frankly. They're expected to do more with less. By that I mean they're not just expected to do their telecasts, but they're also expected to put content on the station's website, in the weather section of the website. They are absolutely expected to blog, Twitter, Facebook. They're expected to make community presentations at schools and other types of community events. So weathercasters are definitely, and you know, I said they're doing more with less, so they're working more media platforms. But the with less portion of that is that they are essentially, over time, their stations are streamlining their news operation because they're less profitable than they used to be. And so the weathercasters have less technical support, less access to producers, less access to assistants who can help them do some of this work. So they really are, you know, one person or, you know, each person on the weather team is essentially, you know, a team, a one-man or one-woman band unto him or herself.
Okay, great. Thanks.
So if you go to the next slide, it shows that the second premise of our work, and again, this is really a premise that Joe Witte brought to me a couple of years ago, which is that not only do weathercasters have an extraordinary opportunity to educate because of their access to us, they also have real news hooks that they can use. News hooks in the sense of weather news. When extreme weather events or unusual weather or climatic events occur, it's a wonderful opportunity to tell a story, not just about the 72-hour forecast, but for weathercasters who are inclined, it's a wonderful opportunity to link the information about that forecast and why it is so extreme or unusual to trends that have been manifesting in communities across America for the past five decades or so. In other words, it's a chance to take today's personal lived experience and link it to the climatic record in a way that will help people understand and personally experience climate change. If you go to the next slide, It starts to foreshadow why I think it's so important for people to personally experience climate change. In fact, I pulled a couple of slides out of this deck in which we have found in our national surveys that people who tell us that they have personally experienced climate change are dramatically more likely to be engaged in the issue. They're dramatically more likely to believe that climate change is real and be certain of it. They're more likely to believe it's a serious threat. They're more likely to believe that we should be taking action. So this notion of personally experiencing climate change is really important. Global warming, global climate change is almost by its very nature an abstraction. And the way we often try to educate people is about using abstract information to help people understand the abstraction of global climate change. Conversely, you know, a hurricane, as you saw on the last slide with Jim Cantore broadcasting in a hurricane, or a severe rainstorm, a severe snowstorm, any sort of extreme weather event, by definition, is extremely concrete. So if you go to the next slide, it simply illustrates that when I say global climate change is an abstraction, this one slide is sort of representative of how we try to represent what's actually been happening in our world. In this case, it's 100 years of heat data in the continental U.S., and one can easily see that the temperature is rising over the course of the century. But that's actually not, processing this kind of risk information is not actually something the human brain is very good at processing. Conversely, the next slide, showing the bear, I mean, that is concrete risk information. People don't need to think, they don't need to strain their brains in order to process the meaning of this risk information. The next slide makes the point that all of us have two parallel risk information processing systems in our brains. This is simply the hardware, the architecture of our brains are structured so that each of us has two distinct complementary but distinct information risk information processing systems. The experiential system, which we would use to process, you know, the threat of an animal attack. It happens very, very fast. It requires no conscious thought. Versus the analytic system, which is the portions of our brain with which we weigh with which we would weigh evidence and use logic. Unlike the experiential system, it's very slow. It requires enormous effort, and it's not something that we like to do more than we need to. We're constantly, all day long while we are awake, we're constantly processing information through our experiential system, but we are only intermittently activating our analytical system because doing so requires conscious effort, and we only have so much conscious effort to spread around. The next slide simply makes the point that I've already made, which is it's not really, although we have these two different information processing systems, they aren't balanced. One is much more instantaneous, one is constantly operating, and the other is only intermittent, requires enormous effort. This actually is a story that, in the next slide, Danny Kahneman, you may have actually already read his current book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Danny's a psychologist currently at Princeton. He and Amos Tversky had collaborated over 30 years on research that essentially identified or helped to understand these two different information processing systems. And so, you know, he represents that as the fast information processing capability of our experiential learning system, and the slow, effortful information processing of our analytical system. One almost always trumps the other. So when we try to teach people about climate change using analytical reasoning and data, you know, data-driven abstractions, it isn't really optimized for people to learn to understand in a deep way what climate change really means. So if you go to the next slide, it's simply my conclusion that severe weather is almost the perfect entree to tie people's lived experiences to this notion of the fact that the climate is changing. And these severe weather events are, in fact, becoming more frequent and or more severe, more extreme. And by tying people's everyday lived experience to longer patterns that, you know, have unfolded over the past five decades, for example, it's a wonderful way to educate people about climate change through their experiential learning system as opposed to primarily through their analytical learning system. So if you go to the next slide, there are essentially two ways in which we can do this. We can, as I've already intimated, we can try to link the current extreme weather event to the trends that have manifest over the past period of time, recent history essentially. And by recent history, I mean recent enough that the old timers in a community would be able to say, yeah, that's right, that makes sense to me. There really has been more of this kind of thing occurring, you know, more recently than in the past. And that the beauty of tying extreme weather events to the, you know, to the past couple of decades is that this doesn't require data that anybody would have a difficult time understanding. People get and by and large accept the fact that we've done a pretty good job of recording these things over the past number of decades. And if the trend isn't, as is the case in this slide, if the trend is consistent with, if the event is consistent with a manifest and observed trend, it's a wonderful way to put the event in clearer contrast. The next slide suggests the other opportunity, and that is to link the current event with what is projected for the future. If you don't like this weather event, you might not like what is projected for our future, because the climate scientists, through their models, are projecting we're going to get more of these, and or we're going to get the events like this that are even worse than this. So again, it's a way to take a concrete lived personal experience and put it in the context of a larger and admittedly more abstract trend. So the third and final premise that our project is based on is that there are a lot of weathercasters out there. There's 1,300 weathercasters, give or take, coast to coast. And Joe's sense all along was that a lot of those 1,300, many of those 1,300 would be willing to cover the issue of climate and climate change. But his sense was they weren't at the time when we started this conversation 3 years ago. He's absolutely right. What we did with his original ideas, we went out and got an NSF grant together. It had three components. The first part of the grant, we actually did what's called snowball interviewing, snowball sampling. We found weathercasters who were actively engaged in educating their viewers about climate change. We interviewed them. These were 1, 2, sometimes even 3 hour interviews. And as part of the interview process, we asked them to share with us the materials they were using to educate their viewers. We termed these people early adopters. And what we found pretty much to our surprise is that we could only find coast to coast through word of mouth sampling, we could only find 17 of these early adopters. It doesn't mean there aren't more. There weren't more at the time, but of the 17 that we did find, they didn't know of any more. The second part of our project was to do a national survey of weathercasters. So we surveyed them all 1,300. We got about a 50% response rate, which is pretty good. And I'm going to show you what we learned from that in a moment, at least a couple of the key findings. And then the third and the final part of that first grant was that we worked with Jim Gandy at WLTX, the Columbia affiliate in Columbia, South Carolina, to actually develop educational materials that he then used in his broadcasts. And Tamara, to your point, he also then put them on his website. I can tell you a little bit about, we're just now finishing the evaluation of that project. I'm delighted to be able to share some positive results from that experience with you. So on the next slide, you see my friend Joe Witte. This is actually a website that we created to archive all of those materials from the 17 early adopters that I mentioned a moment ago. They are our research question, actually, in part, and the reason we conducted these interviews was what are these people doing? What were these 17 weathercasters? How are they going about educating their viewers about climate change? And is that consistent? Are their methods, their pedagogical methods, consistent with the National Academy's most recent report on best practices in informal science education? So you'll see on the left of the slide, if you've got it available to you, that we've got one of the paths in the architecture of this website is the ISE best practices. So for all of the materials that they shared with us, we actually assessed them to determine the degree to which these materials demonstrated one or more of the six strands of informal science education best practices. And you can actually see that on the next slide, which shows Claire Martin, who's not actually an American. She's Canadian, but in Vancouver, very active climate change educator. We decided she was a person we were introduced to. We interviewed her, and we decided to go ahead and include her in our website, even though she's a North American but not a U.S. citizen. But I put this slide up simply to show you that in this website, we've got her materials there or links to her materials. We've sort of scored her materials in terms of showing which of the informal science education best practices she is demonstrating with these particular materials. So the next slide, it begins to show you a couple of the key findings from the National Survey of Weathercasters. And again, confirming Joe's premise, we found that essentially 2 out of 3 weathercasters are very interested in reporting on climate change. So it's the majority. The next slide makes the point that Tamara was bringing up, that they are a smaller number are interested in covering the issue on air than are interested in covering the issue online, their station's website or their blogs, or in community events. And the more we've learned about this distribution, the fact that community events are seen as a better place to do it than on air, it really comes down to the issue of time. They have very little time to even do the 72-hour forecast on air. Really difficult for them to squeeze in a connecting thought between today's weather or tomorrow's predicted weather and the changing climate. But even so, 60%, 61 or 2% said that yes, on air is viable. It's just less viable than online and community education sessions. The next slide indicates sort of a range of different stories that they are interested in covering. I can tell you it's all local. They are not interested in national, much less interested in national stories, not at all interested in global stories. You know, the weathercasters are on covering the local market, and they need to find ways.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
So the people that, for example, aren't interested in extreme precipitation and flooding, is that just because that's not something that happens where they are?
They are, so this would, interested in covering this as a climate story.
Right.
So essentially, this was the climate story that interested the largest number of weathercasters. And the other 50%, yeah, it might be a combination of this doesn't happen in their market, and or they aren't interested in touching this issue. It's just not something they believe in, or it's an issue they feel is too controversial still. And I could talk a little bit about that. There is a sizable group of weathercasters who continue to feel that the science isn't yet settled. It's not that they necessarily don't believe it, the climate isn't changing, but they feel this is still too fluid of an issue for them to want to weigh in on it.
Okay, great, thanks.
So the next slide indicates sort of in broad terms the kind of support that they say they will need in order for this to for them to become more active as climate educators. Again, I want to sort of remind you that they told us that time is their biggest barrier. Lack of time to produce stories and lack of time on air to get the story on air. So we know that fundamentally is the most important barrier that we have to help them overcome. Anything we can do to reduce the time burden is very likely to increase the rate of their reporting on climate change. And as you can see from this slide, they say that access to high quality graphics and animations and ways, as Joe will tell me every time he feels I'm losing sight of this fact, television is a visual medium. It's got to have color. It helps if it has motion. Static images and boring images don't actually accentuate the television viewing experience. So we got to produce high quality graphics and animations that have color and motion to help the nation's weathercasters link currently lived weather events to the larger climatic trends. And the next slide simply shows you how Jim Gandy at WLTX in Columbia has done it. So he actually took the work we did with him, and he turned it into a branded branded segment of the weathercast. It's not every night, obviously. It's only an intermittent segment. When the current weather conditions allow him to sort of work in a Climate Matters segment onto the air, but the fact that he branded it Climate Matters certainly worked very well for his station. You'll see on the next slide, actually, they show the branding down in the lower right. That's Jim and delivering one of the Climate Matters segments. It's very, very clearly branded, so it's clear that he's essentially now going beyond the 72-hour forecast and going into a bigger issue, branded Climate Matters. And then he takes that same content on the next slide. You can see he takes that same content and then he puts it up on the weather segment, section of the WLTX website. So at the bottom of the page, you can see some of the library of segments that he's produced over the past year. You can't see it on this slide, but beneath that is a whole series of print stories that that he has found from various print journalism outlets that he is recommending. And then beneath that and to the right, you can find his blog. So he's a very active blogger. He takes all viewer comments very seriously. He says it's taken him a lot of time to respond to all of the comments, but he feels it's really important that he does so. And we're really, really pleased that he is so devoted in his efforts as a climate educator, because what we have found is we did a survey of a random sample survey of Columbia, you know, adults in the Columbia media market, just prior to the launch of Climate Matters. And then about 15 months later, we followed up and we resurveyed the same people that we surveyed at baseline, plus we surveyed another random sample of adults in Columbia. One is called a panel study, the other is called a cross-sectional study. And we've used both of those two sets of post-test surveys to try to estimate the effect of being a WLTX viewer, essentially, watching Jim Gandy as your weathercaster. And what we've shown, it's not yet completely written, so it hasn't yet been peer-reviewed, but we feel really confident in these findings because we're showing it in both the panel data as well as the cross-sectional data, is that the more people watched the Climate Matters segments, in other words, the more they watched Jim as their weathercaster, the more they adopted science-based views or science-based understanding of climate change. So this is a really important piece of research for us because it's fundamentally confirmation of Joe's, you know, ultimate premise in bringing the idea to me in the first place. When weathercasters educate their viewers about the changing climate and its relationship to the current weather, to current extreme weather events, it does help them better understand what climate change is really all about. So we were only about 12 months into that first grant when we had the opportunity to apply for CSEP Phase 1 funding, which we received. We built our CSEP partnership based on using data essentially using the findings of our TV survey, our TV weathercaster survey. So they told us that NOAA is one of the most trusted sources, that state climatologists were their most trusted source. For some reason, I didn't put AMS and National Weather Association on here. They're professional associations, but those are, in fact, their number three and number four most trusted sources. So if you go to the next slide, you will see that our partnership is essentially composed of those very organizations that weathercasters have told us they trust most. Who, you know, Ed and Joe at George Mason University, great. They know Joe. They don't know me. But and even though they know and like Joe, we're not trusted enough to develop an educational program to develop a support program that would help weathercasters around the nation become climate educators. And that's why it was so important for us that AMS and NWA are our absolute, you know, core partners. They represent 90% of America's weathercasters belong to one or both of those organizations as their professional societies. So they are our partners. They are the way in which we're bringing our programming to the nation's weathercasters. So NOAA was one of our founding partners. NASA joined in the past year. NASA is just delighted with the project, and Joe actually is a half-time employee now at NASA, and the fact that our secret weapon, Joe Witte, was there, helped them understand what a high-impact project this was. So they signed on as a partner as well. Also mid-year, we got UCAR, the COMET program at UCAR, to sign on as a partner because they are really the nation's leading professional continuing education provider for the meteorology community. And what we found in our surveys was that 90% of the nation's weathercasters feel their professional development needs aren't being met currently. And that was almost regardless of their views about climate change. So it wasn't just skeptics who were saying their needs aren't being met, but even the most the segment of weathercasters, the 20% who believe that the climate is changing and like climate scientists, they believe it's principally human-caused, they too told us their professional development needs aren't being met. So we invited COMET to join our team, and they've been really a great addition. So that's really it. That's all I wanted to brief you on. My last slide simply shows our other work that Tamara mentioned before, our Global Warming Six Americas and our Climate Change in the American Mind survey. All of that, as well as all of the research studies that we've done as part of our CSEP Phase 1. So that would be the surveys of weathercasters, two national surveys now. We surveyed their bosses, TV news directors around the nation. You can download that if you're interested from our website. We have surveyed the nation's state climatologists. That report isn't yet finished, but that will soon be on our website. And we have also surveyed the 77 undergraduate training programs around the country. People training undergraduate institutions that are training broadcasters or meteorologists who aren't going to be broadcasters or atmospheric scientists to find to learn more about what they see as their curriculum needs. Because after all, they are the ones who are training broadcasters of the future. And we wanted to make sure that the current graduates or current trainees are really getting the adequate education in climate change, so that when they start working in the meteorology field, and broadcast meteorology in particular, they're bringing that education with them to the experience. So I will stop there and see if you have any questions.
Thanks a lot, Ed. Are there any questions? So, Ed, as you move forward, do you anticipate that will you be communicating with these 1,300 meteorologists, or are you more focused on individual communities or markets?
Oh, no, our eye is definitely on all 1,300. So of the 1,300, 82% essentially are convinced that the climate is changing. But they fall into three distinct subgroups. So those who, like climate scientists, believe the climate is changing due primarily to human activities. Those who believe that it's about 50-50. Those who believe it's primarily due to natural phenomenon, part of the broader cycle of the climate, and those who believe it's more or less, both are major drivers. And what we've shown is that those who hold the view that it is most consistent with climate science are most eager to embrace this role. So that's about 20% of the nation's broadcasters. But the more we have worked with the other two segments of the groups that we call convinced weathercasters, and particularly the more that we have pursued what we call a conflict analysis and resolution agenda with them. And by that, I mean there is a lot of conflict in this community between those people who believe climate is changing due to human activities and those who don't believe it's changing at all. And they've created something of an unpleasant tenor of the dialogue within the community. And so we've been engaged in these conflict resolution workshops at the AMS and the NWA annual meeting. And the more we manage to calm the dialogue, in other words, to get it refocused back on science and get it refocused away from hurt feelings and angry positions that the people on the two sides see as being the other side being political, the more we've calmed the dialogue, the more the weathercasters in the middle, which is the majority of all weathercasters, the more they step forward and say, I actually now get the fact that I have a role to play here. It doesn't matter if the climate is changing, principally due to human activities or whether or not it's just part of the natural cycle of things. If one thing that I am convinced of is it's making the weather worse, less predictable in my community, and therefore I see that as consistent with my own self-image as part of the safety fabric, the public safety fabric in my community, to warn people about things that are happening in our community that could be dangerous for them. So what we found is that, essentially 80% of the nation's weathercasters, we think, are going to want to embrace this role in one way or another. So while we can't sort of meet all of their needs in year one, the five-year plan that we're developing is very much focused on scaling up so that by the end of our project, we have created a program where the vast majority of America's weathercasters have started to redefine their professional role as including the role of climate education.
Ed, this is...
Ed, hi, this is Sarah Maxwell from Storm Center Communications. I do have a question for you.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I was wondering if you've gotten feedback from these weathercasters about pressure from their station managers or the fear of losing viewership by taking a side on this controversial issue and how they deal with that.
So yes, we have. We've asked both the weathercasters and their news directors, you know, to identify the barriers, and a certain minority of weathercasters identify their news directors or their general managers or the station owners as a barrier. But I'm doing this from memory now. I'm going to say it's 20%, give or take, identify, you know, somebody above them in the food chain at the station as a barrier. And then probably about 25%, I think, identify, you know, concern about viewer feedback, you know, viewer backlash as a barrier. But I was at the, actually with Dave, I was at the, Dave Jones, I was at the AMS broadcast meeting in Oklahoma last summer, and I was amazed because quite a few of the speakers made presentations in which they talked about, you know, essentially their debut as a climate educator, that when they decided they had to start addressing either, you know, current weather phenomenon or in one case, a current political situation. And all of them said the same thing, that they were braced for the worst kind of backlash, and nothing happened, that no backlash actually occurred. Jim Gandy recently wrote about a 10-page sort of summary of his experience with Climate Matters for us. And he said very clearly, look, me, my weather team, my general manager, and my news director, we were all braced for and ready to handle public backlash from Climate Matters. But he said it really never happened. We did get some negative viewer feedback. One viewer called and demanded that I be fired. But they said they were really underwhelmed by any negative backlash that they created. So it's kind of the old FDR thing. The only thing to fear is fear itself. There is a lot of fear out there about this, but it turns out that weathercasters who put a toe in the water tend not to find the conditions to be as challenging as they feared.
Ed, this is Alejandro with Brookfield Zoo here. In a sense, you're jumping ahead of some of the scientists that are on the IPCC and others that are still quite reluctant to connect extreme weather with climate change. How, I mean, that seems to be going in your direction, but do you feel that you're stepping ahead of what the science is saying already?
It's a great question, Alejandro, and my answer is an emphatic no. Marty Herling from NOAA is our co-PI on the project. Marty is one of the premier climate attribution scientists, and he's exceedingly conservative on this point. So among the small cadre of climate attribution scientists, there's a range of opinions about, you know, the degree to which the changing climate is influencing current weather conditions. Kevin Trenberth, for example, is quite outspoken in saying it's absolutely a foregone conclusion that every weather event now has the fingerprint of climate change on it because the climatic conditions have changed. Marty is much more cautious about it, and we've adopted his caution. So we don't actually ever tie, we're not encouraging weathercasters to tie a specific weather event to climate change. Instead, we're urging them to use weather events as an illustration of trends. As I'm not sure what point you joined the conversation, Alejandro, but we're trying to get them to link that to trends that have already manifest in their community. So the fact that in Columbia, South Carolina, for example, they are getting more intense rainstorms now than they used to, and so when they had an intense rainstorm or one was predicted in Columbia, it allowed Jim Gandy to go on and say, essentially, you know, this isn't just a freak event. This is the kind of event that is the data show very clearly is happening more frequently now or more severely now because of the change in our climate.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yeah, this is Sarah again. I had one more. I see that you're working mostly on the smaller community level. Do you find, obviously, you're going to have a greater impact when you can reach people at a local level in their own community? Does that mean that there a different approach or not an effective approach on the national level, say with the Weather Channel or CNN's weather?
Yeah, we're mostly focused on local TV simply because there's so many local broadcasters, and moreover because of the data I showed earlier, which is that 50% of Americans say they're getting their weather principally from local TV. So it means we're working at a retail level. We will be working at a retail level with a much larger number of weathercasters, which is challenging. Everything we're doing at the local level translates pretty well for national TV. And it's not like we've lost sight of Weather Channel, and not at all, as a matter of fact. Ray Band from the Weather Channel is one of our scientific advisors for the first grant. We do hope to create materials that are relevant for national audiences. But yes, as you suggested, Sarah, our dominant influence or our focus is on the local.
Ed, this is Scott Carley here. I'm curious about the role of the two professional organizations in continuing education. Is that something that you get pushback? Is this really another way of also working with the meteorologists? You said that 90% of them feel that they're not getting enough, and I don't know whether what they meant by that, they want more and more weather continuing education, or whether they would be open, in fact, to material associated with climate change.
No, yeah, we asked them, Scott, specifically about professional development and continuing education on climate change, and so they weren't saying they don't get they're unsatisfied with their weather related or meteorology related professional development activities. It's that 90% of them weren't satisfied with their climate and climate change related activities.
Well, there's a huge hook.
Oh yeah, no, we absolutely see it that way, and it was AMS and the National Weather Association who actually said that we really should bring Comet into our partnership because they turned to Comet to produce professional development activities, and so rather than try to introduce a whole new dynamic into the ecosystem, we've just decided to work with the ecosystem as it is and try to make sure that we enhance it.
Great, that helps.
Hi, Ed. This is Bruce Moravchik from NOAA. I just was wondering how or whether or not or how you're planning to evaluate the effectiveness of the messaging by the meteorologists within their markets for the public.
Oh, Bruce, you're asking such a good question, and it's a really hard question because we, for example, on the Climate Matters project, pilot test in Columbia, South Carolina, we spent almost as much evaluating it as we spent in developing materials for it. Because simply doing, these surveys it's very expensive. And so we're wrestling with exactly how we're going to take what our limited financial resources for the phase two and get the most bang for the evaluation buck, so to speak. Our evaluator is Rockman et al. Out of San Francisco, and so Saul was with us in phase one, but phase one we didn't actually have a program for him to evaluate. Phase two we've got this national program that I've sort of briefly identified, and his challenge, which he's actively working on right now, is how do we take X number of dollars per year and do the most scientifically rigorous evaluation possible. If I had more details that I could share with you, I would, but truly this is sort of our unanswered $64,000 question at the moment.
Right. Thanks very much.
We have to answer it real fast, by the way, because our phase two proposal is due on March 21st.
Indeed.
Yeah, I guess I was asking the question because I'm curious to know whether or not it might be possible to engage more formalized captive audiences, such as those in classrooms at the high school level or even at the university level with the messaging by your meteorologist as sort of test cases.
And that's definitely a possibility is taking, taking the material and sort of, taking it and testing it in sort of small sentinel sites. So, for example, bring a meteorologist to a university, audience and let him or her do their education and just do a simple pre-post test evaluation right then and there. So I'm expecting Saul Rockman will come back to us with some ideas along those lines. We will be surveying the nation's meteorologists every year for the next 5 years. So, you know, one way we can get a sense of how they're responding to the program is by, you know, tracking the degree to which they tell us they are now embracing the role as climate educator. We'll also be able to, of course, track the rate at which they download the materials we develop for them from our website. And we'll, you know, they'll be required to register in order to be, you know, qualified to download materials. So we do have that as well. And then the third mechanism that we do have and will continue to use is our the climate change in the American Mind National Surveys of the Public. So we have already started asking the public whether or not they've noticed a TV weathercaster, you know, talking about climate change. And that's just sort of one level of the evaluation. But we're developing a whole battery of questions to try to get at public awareness of TV weathercasters as climate educators and public reaction to that.
Great, thank you.
So, Ed, you've talked a bit about engaging with those TV weathercasters who are interested in including climate change messages and information in their work. Have you engaged with deniers at all, or is that not an area you've been dealing with very much?
It's an area
denier TV forecasters.
Right. No, I got it. And here's the most. Yes, the answer is yes. And the most important thing I have learned from them is that they feel the word denier is a hater's term. They feel that it's unfair and that it links them intentionally links them to Holocaust deniers, and they're outraged by it, and a lot of their anger that they feel as a result of being disrespected and dismissed. Really is tied into being called deniers. So I personally have learned never to use that term.
How do you refer to that segment?
We refer to them as unconvinced. And we refer to those who tell us that the climate is not changing, we refer to them as unconvinced. Those who tell us that they haven't yet made up their mind, we refer to them as undecided. And then all the 82% who do believe the climate is changing for one reason or another, we refer to them as convinced. I just wanted to make that point before I lost it. But the larger, you know, sort of the in response to your question, these conflict analysis and resolution groups we've been doing, the way we do those is at the annual meetings of the AMS broadcast meeting and the NWA meeting, we recruit people who hold diverse views about climate change. So we recruit members of the unconvinced, we recruit members of the undecided, and we recruit members from across the spectrum of the convinced. And we put them in a room for 3.5 hours with a professional facilitator, a professional conflict mediator, and we essentially create an opportunity for them to express their views in a way in which the only ground rule is you will deal with each other with mutual respect. You know, disrespectful tones, disrespectful comments will not be allowed. And our moderator, Sarah Cobb, she's the dean of our School of Conflict Analysis and Resolution at Mason. She's amazingly tough in terms of enforcing any transgressions of the one ground rule. And what we have found is that the side that wants to transgress first, the side that is most inclined to transgress, are weathercasters who believe that the climate is changing and primarily due to human activities, and they feel really strongly about that. And they have a real hard time reining in their disrespect for their peers who have reached different conclusions. And so what we found, in these conflict sessions, when Sarah Cobb essentially does enforce the ground rule with the very weathercasters who most they all believe she's most likely to feel sympathy towards, it's a very clear message for the ones who are unconvinced or undecided that we're really serious, that what we're trying to do within the weathercaster community is get back to a focus on the science. So if the science isn't yet convincing some weathercasters, what we should be doing is making sure that those unconvinced weathercasters have a chance to have dialogue with the climate scientists who are doing the research. And it's entirely plausible that weathercasters may well have identified, you know, they may well hold valid reasons as to why they aren't yet convinced. And it's really it's really the responsibility of the climate science community to do a better job of marshaling their data to at least address those concerns. And so by changing the dynamic of the dialogue within the weathercaster community, as I said before, what we're finding is it sort of takes the anger out of the room, and the weathercasters in the middle of the continuum, those who believe, for example, that the climate is changing mostly due to natural cycles, they still walk away feeling like this issue is relevant to them. They, for the first time, they've made the connection between their job as a TV weathercaster and climate change, and they see the role they should consider playing.
Ed, this is Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. I've been sort of in and out, I've been multitasking. One thing I might offer as a suggestion for those who have been listening in today and also those who listened in a couple weeks ago to Dave Jones is to realize that there are some TV forecasters out there who are convinced, who want to try to do something. And I know many of the folks listening in are educators at schools or at museums. And you probably have about a dozen TV forecasters in your market. If you count, the four networks, so to speak, and they've got weekend people, morning people, and evening people. So between 10 and 12 people are probably doing weather in your TV market. If you had a chance to reach out and find one of those people who is interested in doing climate, that would be helpful probably for your outreach activities, and also would help the forecaster feel like he's got somebody on his side, so to speak, somebody of common belief. And so I encourage you to look about and see if there's a forecaster in your market who is trying to do something on climate or who might want to do something on climate. If he had a little support, I think he'd be a useful, beneficial gathering of the mind.
Yep, I agree with that completely. And again, Joe, you probably weren't on the phone when I said that when I walk around Washington, normally I'm anonymous, but when I walk with you, I'm standing next to a local celebrity. And if a zoo or an aquarium brings in a local climate scientist to give a talk, great, that's interesting. But if they bring in the local weathercaster to give a talk on climate change, there's some star power there.
Oh, there's a station in Orlando who just partnered with a science museum in Orlando, and they're just ecstatic as museum runners or organizers to have that partnership just because of the popularity. And I think most people are probably trying to throw snowballs at me.
Snowballs in Orlando.
Yeah.
Okay, we are a few minutes past the hour, or is there any more last-minute questions for Ed? Okay, then. Well, thanks, Ed, very much. And, Joe, I'm glad you were able to be on, even though we only heard from you in the last minute or so. And thanks very much for your presentation and discussion.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ed.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks a lot.
Great. Bye to everyone.